Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Dow may look happy, corporate earnings all smiles, but a whole lot of people are still wondering where the U.S. economy and the global economy are really headed. Economist Daniel Altman has been looking farther out at deep, long-term trends. We've got his report this hour on point, Deep Trends, Long Trends for an Unsettled Economy. You can join the conversation. What's your question, your hope, your fear on our economic future? Joining me now from New York is economist Daniel Altman. He's been a columnist for the New York Times, International Herald Tribune, The Economist, now a director of Dahlberg Global Development Advisors, a consulting firm that specializes in international development. Founder of North Yard Economics, his new book is Outrageous Fortunes, the 12 Surprising Trends That Will Reshape the Global Economy. Daniel Altman, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So everybody's worried right here at home. We've got all these great corporate earnings and, pretty good pay packages on Wall Street again. Dow up at a nice fat spot again, at least back to where it was before the great crash. And yet, jobs barely being created. We're going to look very long term, but let us get a feeling for your sense of where we are right now, Daniel. What do you think we're looking at?
Well, we're looking at something that's pretty typical for the exit from a downturn in this country. First, we usually see liquidity returning to the credit markets, and then the stock market starts to go up because the stock market is really based on people's expectations for long-term earnings by firms. And then, after a little while, we start to see growth in the economy. We have seen that, perhaps not rapid growth, but moderate growth returning, and unemployment finally starts to come down. Unemployment comes down last in this process because it's only when firms feel comfortable about hiring people again that they're going to do that. And for that, they need to have the capital flowing in. They need to see demand for their products, and it's just starting to happen now.
You say typical recovery, and yet people compare, the recovery from this crash, recession, whatever you want to call it, to others where we've seen something more like a V-shape, down and then back. This has looked for a long time like an L-shape, down and then just down and down and down. If it comes back, it's certainly taking a long time to make that upward climb again.
Well, it's definitely deeper. It's the deepest recession we've had in many decades. And as a result, it's been more slow in recovering because we do have that uncertainty that has been lingering now for a couple of years. There have just been a lot more precautionary measures taken by firms. They are trying to keep lean and mean before they know really what's going to happen. In the shorter recessions that we've had, we've tended to see a kind of slingshot effect where there's pent-up demand for goods and services. There's pent-up plans for hiring and things like that, which all of a sudden get released as soon as that uncertainty is dispelled and demand starts to return. With this case, it has taken a couple of years. I actually think that we're lucky that it's only taken a couple of years. Things could have been much worse.
You say that word uncertainty. Business people throw it around a lot these days. It's often applied to government policy and what that is or what that's going to be. But is there also a kind of uncertainty now about where the whole global economy is going? Are people uncertain about that, how to attack it? Or is it just the American economy that they're worried about?
There's definitely uncertainty about the global economy as well. I think that if you look around the world, one thing we do know is that a lot of developing countries are going to be growing quickly in the next few years. We see rapid growth in all of the regions where we have a lot of developing countries, Latin America, Asia, Africa. But what we don't know is where the sort of global economic power balance is going to reside, let's say 10, 20, 40 years into the future. We don't know how good a lot of these countries are going to be at making the long-term investments that will propel their economies in the future, that will exploit all the potential of their talent.
And the American standing within that global picture. I mean, there's a whole school of thought out there now that's become very sort of sour on that American future. Tyler Cowen, columnist of the New York Times, has got a new book out called The Great Stagnation, I think, where he says we've plucked all our low-hanging fruit. We had, three centuries of virgin continent to roll around in and be prosperous in. That's gone, and we haven't figured out the American way ahead. What do you say to that view, Daniel?
I think we'd actually plucked most of the low-hanging fruit in this country a couple of decades ago, and we are at the point where we are having to innovate to push our economy forward. We are having to do things that will help us to get productivity out of our workers, and those things are some of the same things the president outlined in his recent State of the Union address, investing in education and basic research and infrastructure. But, you know, countries like China, which is growing so fast right now, are going to face the same problem pretty soon because I think they also had a lot of low-hanging fruit. They also had the rural to urban migration that we had in this country. They had the copying of technologies and then exporting them more cheaply like Japan did. Those trends run out of steam. And when that happens, China's going to be facing the same challenge that we are.
All right, let's look around the world a little bit. We'll come back to the American picture here because it seems to me we've got anything but figured out right now. And for those many, many people without jobs, it doesn't feel figured out. That only 36,000 jobs created last month. People were thinking maybe it'd be 130 or 140,000 jobs. It wasn't. You've got some big long-term predictions about major players in the global economy. You mentioned China. Let's go right there. You say they're on their upswing right now, but it is not likely to last forever or maybe not even that long. And then what, Daniel?
Well, as I said, they've got a couple of big trends that are propelling their growth right now. One is that rural to urban migration, taking people off the farms, getting them into cities where they can work in factories and big service operations. That's a big propeller of their growth. It propelled growth in this country as well. It propelled growth in Japan. The other one, as I said, they were copying a lot of technologies, reverse engineering them, manufacturing them more cheaply, and then exporting them. That's something that Japan was able to take advantage of too. But we know that both of those trends run out of steam. China is moving through economic time faster than the United States or Japan did. They are just making these advances much more quickly, and that means these trends are going to run out of steam more quickly as well. I think that they will probably in about 20 years. And by that time, China may be the biggest economy in the world in terms of just brute output. But I think that at that point, they'll settle down into a long-term steady growth pattern, just like Japan and the U.S. did. Now, when Japan did, they settled into a growth pattern that was actually less rapid than that of the United States. They're growing less quickly than we are. I think China's going to do the same because China does not have the institutions that favor entrepreneurship and innovation, like protections for investors and legal frameworks and free markets. I think that as a result of that, the United States is going to start to catch up to China again. It's going to pass China. And I don't see it really looking back.
If China settles into a steady state, what does that state look like? Is it an advanced economy with a standard of living, with a per capita GDP that rivals the U.S., Japan? Or does it still have its big impoverished backwater?
I don't think it's going to reach the standards of living that you see in the United States and Japan. We might see something a bit more like Korea. Korea is still growing pretty quickly, but in Korea, you see standards of living that are on average about half of what they are in the United States. And we're going to see probably something like that when China begins to settle down. Then the question will become, will China change the deep factors in its economy so that they can push back the finish line a little bit and make another jump forward? I think that they may have a lot of trouble doing that because the things that are likely to hold them back have roots that are thousands of years old in things like Confucian philosophy, which creates hierarchical systems in business, and that can discourage innovation.
You've got a lack of openness to trade on that front, too much red tape, an aging population, a very big deal there, harder maybe to start a business in China. If China then plateaus after a couple of decades here, what does that mean for the United States? Is that good in some sense because we have not quite such a ferocious competitor? Is it bad because we don't have such growing markets potentially for American goods there? How does that play out for this country?
Well, we're definitely getting a lot of boost from the possibility that China's middle class, which is growing quite rapidly, will buy our products. And we need to think about how we're going to cater to them and make products that they want to buy. But I think that it's a mixed story for the United States. Overall, China's growth and its ability to compete with the United States in higher skill occupations, it's something that we've had to do before. You know, we've had to compete with Japan. We're competing with Korea. We're competing with countries in Western Europe, all these wealthy countries that are trying to produce high-value goods and services. We've withstood that competition before. Often the exchange of ideas that results can sharpen us and help us to move forward. You know, we learned a lot from the Japanese manufacturing processes, for example, and that's helped to raise our productivity in this country. So it doesn't have to be a bad story. But in terms of pure economic might, how much sort of weight the United States wields on the world stage, the fact that we will probably again be number one in the world as far as the biggest economy may be good news for that kind of thing.
Does it matter who's the biggest economy in terms of American prosperity here? What if it's the other scenario? You say you're no Nostradamus in prediction, but there are others who see China just going and going and going, not plateauing. What's the difference for the U.S. if it continues roaring up in terms of its national wealth and economy size, or it plateaus? What difference does it make for the USA?
Well, we start to get into areas that, as an economist, I feel less comfortable in, because we're starting to talk about what country can sort of try and spread its values in the world. And definitely, if you're the biggest economy in the world, you have an advantage there, because you can build more things like aircraft carriers. You can buy more fuels and move international markets and other commodities. So I think that, you know, it's really a power play or a power dynamic. Now, I'll abstract from that a little bit and say, well, look at countries that have been left behind in the past, like the United Kingdom or Germany or the Netherlands even, which was a huge trading power a couple centuries ago. Yeah, they've done okay. It hasn't mattered to them so much that they were no longer number one. They've managed to cut out niches where they're successful in the global economy and their people's living standards have continued to rise.
Can the United States be a successful niche player? I think that's one of the things people are trying to grapple with. We've been so big. We've been number one for so long. Can we be a niche player and be a prosperous, widely prosperous country?
I don't really think we're looking at being a niche player. I mean, even if China passes us, we're going to be very big there. The difference between China and the United States will be smaller than the difference between China and the United States today, even if China is ahead of us. But we're not looking at being a niche player. We're still going to be a big engine of the global economy, and I think we're still going to be the place that's most attractive for a lot of entrepreneurs to come and do their business, because we offer perhaps not the best possible, but one of the best environments in the world for entrepreneurship and innovation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with economist Daniel Altman about the U.S. economy, the global economy, and the big trends stretching out in front of us right now. His new book is Outrageous Fortunes. President Obama reaching out to the American business community yesterday at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, right across the park from the White House. Here he is.
We can and we must work together, whatever differences we may have. I know that all of us share a deep, abiding belief in this country, a belief in our people, a belief in the principles that have made America's economy the envy of the world.
Deep and abiding belief in this country, in our people. It's the economy we're talking about here today. Those people need jobs, maybe, to keep up that bigger belief. Daniel Altman joins us from New York. Daniel, we've got a lot of response here already. Here's one. This is a Facebook comment from Mark. He says, I'm an engineer. I have a lot of highly valuable experience and skills, constantly adapting and training despite this. I was the victim of large-scale layoffs twice in 2 years. I was replaced through outsourcing. Still employed, lucky, but he says until we bring manufacturing back to the U.S., we will not have a robust economy. And he adds this, he says, in a nutshell, overpaid execs get bonuses to lay off overpaid, low- and minimum-paid workers. They get paid big for sending American jobs out of the country. What about that conundrum? Think about Mark's situation there. Very well trained, but feels constantly under the gun, faced layoffs himself. What's he got coming?
Well, I want to make a few comments on what Mark said. Thanks for the comment, by the way. First of all, I would say manufacturing has never left this country. What has happened is there's been less manufacturing employment. The value of the output that we create in the manufacturing sector has risen steadily all through the period when the manufacturing sector has been shedding jobs. And the reason for that is very simple. We've been using more equipment and other types of capital to produce the manufactured goods, and we're also making higher value manufactured goods. So we're just doing more with fewer people. That's not necessarily a bad thing for our economy, but we need to find other things for those people to do. They are highly skilled people like Mark, and we've done a terrible job so far of managing the transition from a less globalized to a more globalized world. You know, we need some way of taking advantage of the talents of all these people who are looking for a new job. They need to be able to make that transition. We need to spread out the gains from trade. And there are a lot of gains. As consumers, we have tremendously better lifestyles because of the trade we do. But we need to spread those gains around. Now, when I had a chance to talk to President Obama's former economic advisor, Christina Romer, I said, how about something like a new GI Bill that will help people displaced by globalization instead of displaced by a world war like we had in the 40s? Why not give them a chance to retool and retrain? But I'm glad that President Obama was at the Chamber of Commerce because he's going to need the help of corporate America to do this. We've looked at training programs over the years, and the ones that work best are the ones that are training on the job. When government takes over the program, it doesn't work so well. We need education, and then we need training on the job. So I think if we have a nationwide effort to solve this problem of the transition, we could do a lot better for people like Mark.
I have to push back a little bit because I've seen too many people kind of harumph when people talk about training. We've read the stories of those who have gone out and gotten more training and still don't have the job. Look at Mark's own story. He says he's an engineer, experience, skills, constantly adapting and training. Nevertheless, twice in 2 years, victim of he was replaced by outsourcing. So he's already up to speed and he still can't do it. You say we've got manufacturing, but something is missing there if an engineer can't find a job.
One of the things that's missing is a market for training. There's little incentive for companies to invest in their people because their people could leave at any time.
But hold it right
it
there.
Works both
he
ways.
Says he's got the training. He says he's got the training. It's the job he's missing, not the GI Bill, not more training. He says he's got it. He's up to speed. Doesn't have a job.
He may not have the job, but he has some options. He can wait around and hope that his skills will be picked up by this economy, which is moved by forces that are larger than Mark or me or you. Or he can look in other places. He can try to retrain again. Obviously, there's a very fast-moving target for him, perhaps more than for either of us. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I talk about in the book is the opportunities that are opening up for professionals around the world. I think that migration policy, transportation, internet communications, all of these things are making it easier for people to do jobs in different places. And really, labor is the big laggard in globalization. We've moved goods around the world with such ease. We move money around the world, even ideas around the world. But we don't move people around the world that easily. And if we can do more of that, then it might be easier for someone like Mark to find a job, perhaps not where he is now, but somewhere else, perhaps
in a different
country. Is
that really our future? Mark, find your future in China? How are we supposed to sit down around the Thanksgiving table together for all, I don't know, is that really it? Go find a job in Vietnam, in China, in, Poland?
Well, the economy is in a constant state of transformation. There are always new industries being created and other industries that are falling by the wayside. You know, if Mark were a horse-drawn carriage driver today, we would say, well, sorry, Mark. But obviously, he's making an effort to keep his skills up to date. What I think, though, is if you look around the world, more and more people are having to do this. They're having to move or take a job abroad, even with a company that's based in their home country, in order to use their skills the way they were intended. And it's something that we're probably going to have to get used to as well.
Wow. Could be swept right around the globe by globalization. Austin, Texas. Randy is calling. Hi, Randy. You're on the air with Daniel Altman.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for this. I just want to contest what your guest had just said about no job loss in America. I was in the hardware business, nuts and bolts and fasteners, for 10 years, and we had a thriving business from Austin to Chicago, El Paso.
Were you distributing or manufacturing? What end of it, Randy?
Distributing and manufacturing custom parts.
Okay.
And in the summer of 2002 and 2003, thousands of our customers everywhere from all these states, including Mississippi, where they were already low paid, lost their jobs because those jobs moved out of the country, period.
So
they left.
So what about Daniel Altman might well say, well, then, retrain, find it, make something fancier than hardware.
Yeah. I'm 60 years old. I'm driving a truck because they can't send me to China.
Randy, thanks for your call. Daniel, what do you say to Randy and maybe Randy's kids? You're looking long-term here.
Well, I think, Randy's 60 years old. It's going to be difficult for him, as we all know, in today's workforce. There is just not enough of a premium placed on experienced people like him who can really contribute to a company, even though they may not have that many years left in what they would hope their working life to be. But his children certainly can look deep into the future. We have an opportunity now to invest in the next generation so that they can get the right skills they need to succeed. This is rhetoric that we've all heard before, but the fact is it's true. If you look at investments that we can make as a society, education and basic research, which helps to create new industries, have the biggest returns. But it's very hard to get our politicians to focus on them because they may not pay off for 10 years or a generation. Our politicians are facing a 2-year electoral cycle, and the campaign campaign can last as many as 22 months, as we've seen in recent times. So there's not much time for them to focus on the long term. We need to send them a message that they need to make these investments so we can spawn these new industries and have the people who are trained to work in them.
President Obama certainly talked a lot about what he, in the State of the Union and other venues, has called investments in that long term. But yesterday, at the Chamber of Commerce, across the street from the White House in Washington, he was pushing for something more immediate. I want to play some of this tape and ask you about this challenge that he put to that big hall full of business leaders.
But as we work with you to make America a better place to do business, I'm hoping that all of you are thinking what you can do for America. Ask yourselves what you can do to hire more American workers, what you can do to support the American economy and invest in this nation.
President Obama yesterday with business leaders. Daniel Altman, he pointed to the trillions that American business has sitting on the sidelines. And then he also challenged American business leaders to make jobs here. Now, you're talking about long-term education, investments in infrastructure. What about business decisions? The implication there was they have a choice, and they may choose, you know, to boost their business abroad or boost their business and employment right here in this country, and they should do that. How do you respond to that apparent challenge from the president to business leaders yesterday?
Well, business leaders are facing a quandary because they might want to do these things, but they are ultimately accountable to their shareholders. And if their shareholders feel that they are spending money in a way that doesn't benefit the company, then their share prices will drop and the options that that company has in the future will be limited. Now, that's not to say that this is a zero-sum game at all. In my work at Dahlberg Global Development Advisors, we work with a lot of companies around the world to help them improve their impact on local communities, usually in poorer countries, when they make big installations in those countries, set up big operations in those countries. We should be doing the same thing here because there are a lot of investments that executives face where perhaps they have one alternative which pays a certain return and wouldn't necessarily help a community, and there's another alternative which pays virtually the same return but would make a local impact on people's living standards and their jobs.
That seems to be the kind of thing President Obama's talking about. He's saying, come on, let's do it. Do it here. What about that?
Yeah, well, I think some of these companies are just getting used to thinking about this when they work with poorer countries, but they need to think about it with the United States too. You know, there are definitely ways that they can improve their links with the community, and that can benefit them in the long term. But again, executives, just like our politicians, do not have an incentive always to focus on the long term. There are some new rules about corporate compensation that are trying to push their horizon out a couple of years, but we've still got this quarterly earnings culture where they just have to make a number every 3 months. That's not helping them to make these investments.
One of the things you look at here is countries where, I mean, you mentioned capitalism and people feeling, people on the outside looking in feeling burned by it lately. You say, and you point out there's been a backlash against it in some third world countries, speaking of the third world. How do you see that going? Is that likely to grow? Is that likely to falter?
Well, I think we see that backlash even in the United States and some of the wealthier countries. We certainly saw it in the worst days of our downturn. I think that this backlash is sort of a cyclical thing. It's almost like a pendulum, in fact. We see a lot of poorer countries. They are swinging between a left-wing populist regime like you might see in Venezuela or Bolivia today and a right-wing authoritarian kind of business-friendly regime like you might see in a country like Singapore. And they're just going back and forth. But some of these countries have found a way to actually still the pendulum, and it tends to go like this. They have a center-right government that has some links to business that usually comes in and puts in the kinds of economic policies that a lot of global investors are looking for. Tight fiscal balances, a pretty tight monetary policy too without too much inflation, and a floating currency. When that happens, we tend to see more investment flowing into these countries from abroad, and that helps to raise economic growth and employment. But what really solidifies this growth is when that government is followed by more of a center-left government that says, hey, these are good policies. We can legitimize them by spreading around some of the gains that have come as a result of this growth. So you get governments like Lula da Silva in Brazil, Bachelet in Chile, now Mujica in Uruguay. They're saying, okay, we're not going to change these policies. We don't want to scare away investors, but we do want to make sure that we get some grassroots growth out of this where we're helping all of our people to take advantage of their own talents. That's when the pendulum seems to still. That's when you get stable long-term growth.
Where do you see the United States in that pendulum swing right now? American politics, American policy.
Well, the thing that can start a stilled pendulum swinging again is when you have a surprise, when you put someone into office and you think they're pretty much staying in the center, but it turns out that actually they're moving to an extreme again. Then people get angry and they say, oh, now I want to react to the other side once again and keep that pendulum swinging. I think that's what we saw with George W. Bush. I think Bush was a lot more to the right than people expected when he was elected. There were some commentators, even esteemed publications like my former employer, The Economist, where they were saying, hey, there's not that much to choose between Gore and Bush. Turned out that wasn't the case. Bush was so far to the right, I think that helped Obama to get elected, someone who perhaps would have been too far to the left in another election. And now the pendulum is swinging again, much more than it was before.
Do you see Obama as to the left? The Chamber of Commerce certainly painted that on him. Conservatives call him socialist. Do you see Obama as that real leftward swing? Or others say, no, this is a natural-born centrist here.
I don't think it takes very much to get called a socialist in this country, to be honest. If you want to talk about something which in many countries would be taken as given, like a universal health care system, all of a sudden you got a lot of people who are calling you a socialist. So I certainly wouldn't say that. But as far as where this country is right now, he's pretty far to the left. There are a lot of people who could come from, I'd say, either party who might be considered more centrist. But I don't think that in the global stage he's far to the left at all. In fact, I think if he were to run for office in a country like France or Germany, he might be considered to the right. Now, some people would say, well, that's a disparagement of Obama because we think those countries are basically communist. I don't think that's true. I think these countries have chosen a different system that benefits their people in a different way, and they've chosen it not based on how much economic growth they can get, but how happy their people are.
Didn't sound very left standing in front of the Chamber of Commerce yesterday. Daniel Altman's new book is Outrageous Fortunes. Jim in Williamsburg, Kentucky. Jim, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I've got a question for your guest there. My financial advisor has basically said in so many words that things are going to be better this year because of the effect of the stimulus money, which is now being realized, but that the year beyond this one, that there are storm signals flying. One concern of mine, too, is I've been watching overseas markets, and you've got the situation in places like Ireland, and then, of course, Greece is the poster child
right.
for this mess. But I'm kind of wondering, with the way that global economies are now becoming linked, is what are the ramifications for us? And this debt thing has got me scared.
Let us pick both those up. I guess Europe and the troubles there and debt at home. Daniel Altman, speak to those. Those are big pieces.
Two things can happen in these situations. When there's trouble abroad, sometimes we see a flight to safety, as investors call it, which is they want to go somewhere a bit safer with their money. And often that place is the United States. Even in the depths of the downturn, the worst moments of the financial crisis, the United States was considered one of the safest places to invest. Now, that is basically a temporary phenomenon that may help us a bit in the short term, but it doesn't help the whole global economy in the long term. Trouble anywhere is going to hurt the whole global economy in the long term. Now, I think, as I read in the book, there are some possible problems in Europe. I think the euro area is probably untenable in the long term because its members are heading in vastly different directions economically. Whether I see these storm clouds all gathering in 2012, I'm not sure, but certainly in 2012 we'll have uncertainty associated with a presidential election, and that may cause a lot of firms to hold back, wait for the outcome of the election, and then try and set their priorities based on the policies they expect from the winner. Now, on the second point, the debt. Yes, I worry about the debt as well. In fact, a year or so ago when I saw pundits on the television who were calling for $500 billion in new stimulus, I was asking myself, geez, do we know if that's going to take us closer to that line where all of a sudden somebody doesn't show up for the weekly Treasury auction and there's a crisis of confidence in American debt? How close are we to that precipice where the markets suddenly turn against us? Because it can happen in a flash, and then the whole house of cards collapses. So I thought that we were getting dangerously close to that. We saw a couple warnings from credit rating agencies in the last couple weeks, and we know that credit rating agencies, if they're putting out warnings, probably the news happened 6 months ago. So I think that we should be very careful with incurring new debt here. But there's one solution, which is these investments in the long-term potential of our economy to grow, like education, basic research. If we put money into them, investors will give us the money because they know it's going to help our economy to grow in the long term, and we'll be better able to pay back those debts.
I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with economist Daniel Altman about the U.S. economy, the global economy, and the big trends stretching out in front of us. His new book is Outrageous Fortunes, 12 Surprising Trends That Will Reshape the Global Economy. You've heard a couple of them. China up and down, European Union disintegration, he sees coming out there. Immigration, we'll talk about, and more. Let's get a caller right here from Spokane, Washington. Patty. Patty, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to give some advice to the guy that has the engineering job, but he says he's not marketable.
Yeah.
He has a skill that is really wanted in the world. He speaks flawless American English. There are millions of jobs out there. If you just go to international schools, you don't need a teaching credential. You don't need experience. They want you. They just want you to come pick somewhere in the world you want to go. Thailand, you want to go to Fiji, you want to, wherever you want to go.
So stop driving that truck and go teach English in Fiji?
For 2 years, come back to the United States, you get a job because if you got international experience. It doesn't have anything to do with your engineering degree. Just get out there. They want your English. You go to Japan, go to...
We got it. Fiji's calling. Patty, I appreciate your call from Spokane. Let me get one more right here from Sam in Malden, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hey. Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Well, Sam.
My call.
Yeah, what do you see?
Appreciate it. If I might wax philosophical for a minute, I'd ask our guest to step back a little bit. I'm reminded of the scientist Alfred Korzybski, who invented general semantics, best known for a saying that goes like this: the map is not the territory. And I think my eyes glaze over when I start hearing economists speak because they confuse the map for the territory. And the territory is, how are people doing? How are their lives? How are they going? And I think what we've got here is a really bad map. The map just doesn't work anymore. And people, I don't care how Wall Street is doing anymore because it has nothing to do with me. It's a gambling casino.
So what do you think's going on, Sam?
Well, I think what's going on is we're doing really bad. And it's been going downhill since I was a little kid. I'd say the last 30 to 35 years. I'm talking about the United States now. Standard of living every year gets worse. And those are the things to look at. That's what economists need to look at, not finance and money and capital gains and all that hooey that doesn't mean anything to people living their lives. They're looking to see, how are my children doing? Is my life better than the life of my parents? And I can say for myself and every one of my conspecifics in my generation, things, for the most part, have gotten worse. In the 1960s, that was the heyday for a lifestyle in America. It's gotten worse every year. And you need to step back and say, why is that? Why are things continually getting worse for most Americans? Not better, worse.
Stick with us, Sam. Daniel, what do you say to Sam? I mean, that is the voice that many people could call in and share. The map is not the territory, and the real ground he sees is things getting worse. Now, are you going to argue with that, Daniel?
I'm going to respond to him in three ways very quickly. First of all, as far as the map not being the territory, absolutely right. In fact, I think we have a bad map in a couple different ways. As I wrote in one of my previous books, which is called Connected, we think somehow in this country and in other countries around the world that the goal of economic policy should be to create growth and money. That's not true. If you ask any economist, the goal of economic policy should be to create utility, which means welfare, well-being, satisfaction. That's what we're really looking
quality
for.
Quality of life.
Exactly. If we're not getting that, then the growth doesn't matter at all. And that's why some countries that don't grow as quickly as the United States may be happier, because they've set different priorities. We need to have a debate about that nationally. The other problem is that we don't have very good figures. Even the map that we're using right now has a lot of problems in the statistics, especially for our trade balances and employment. So it's very difficult for us to set policy well if we don't have good statistics. Finally, one of the reasons why living standards have deteriorated for some people in this generation is that we did not make as many of these investments in education and research and infrastructure as we should have in the last couple of decades. Our infrastructure gets a D from our engineers. Mm-hmm. We saw funding for science being frozen during the Bush administration. We need to get back on the wagon with these things.
Get the map closer to the territory again. Sam, thanks for your call. David in Savannah, Georgia. David, you're on the air.
Okay, thanks. I think there's a little bit of my thunder just stolen, but I can still take it further, I think. As you're talking, I see you kind of tiptoeing around a subject that keeps coming to my mind that I think is very relevant, and that is the growing disparity of wealth in the United States, particularly, that started around 1977 and has really taken off hyperbolically since then. And I think that a lot of our problems have to do, like with the financial markets we were just talking about, is that there are two classes of people, and because so much of the wealth is up in the upper hands, and so little is left for the lower, we have an excess of wealth at the top, which causes some of these bubbles and bursts, because the people at the top that have the money, the corporations, the very wealthy people, they tend to go after bubbles because that's a way of making their already large money even larger.
Yeah.
So I think the cyclical thing, and I think the taking, basically, the not spreading of the wealth, so that the people that actually would spend causes us to have a lot of our consumption ability is not able to keep up with our production ability. Therefore, we get unemployment.
David, you're thinking well, and you're thinking hard here. I appreciate it. I want to put that to Daniel while we have time. Daniel, what do you say to that observation? And these disparities are enormous now in this country, huge. What does that mean for our economic health? I mean, obviously, if you're not on the top, you're not going to do nearly as well. But what about just overall economic health and our willingness to take the steps as a country that we need to take to get to that greater economic health you're talking about?
Well, globalization around the world has been a force that has reduced inequality between countries but has often increased inequality within countries. And that's because it's the people who are the wealthiest, who have the best education and connections, who are best able to take advantage of the opportunities that globalization creates around the world. Now, some countries have taken a proactive stance here and said, hey, we know that this could polarize our income distribution. Let's do something about it. In the UK, during Tony Blair's government, they actually raised taxes on higher income people, and they were able to mitigate somewhat this increase in inequality. We didn't do that here. We did the opposite. We actually lowered taxes on higher income people. So we're seeing this disparity grow. And this disparity can be very costly. There's research by Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee at MIT that shows that too much inequality will slow down your economic growth. So it's bad for all of us in the long term.
I want to plow through some of your other long-term trends. I'm sure people are interested. One, you say the new colonialism, what is that, will leave colonizers and colonized worse off in the long run. Very quickly, what are you talking about there, the new colonialism?
Well, we used to see colonialism at the end of the barrel of a gun. We don't see that anymore. Now we see colonialism with a big check. Countries like China and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are giving billions of dollars to countries around the world, mostly poor countries, but not exclusively, to buy up or lease their land for farming, their water resources, their mining resources, fuels, etc. Now, these countries usually have not so great governments, sometimes corrupt, or sometimes they just can't absorb this much money so quickly into their economies. So a poor country is going to take this billion-dollar check, because you know no politician will refuse, and say, sure, you can lease our farmland. Well, what happens in a couple of years when we have a food shortage, let's say in a country like Guinea? Do you think the Guineans are going to look on as the Saudis cart away all their food and say, hey, well, we did a deal with them, that's it? I think they're going to renegotiate. They're going to want to create a new deal, and that's going to create political strife both domestically and also with the Saudis. Now, the Saudis, on the other hand, are going to say, hey, we thought we had these resources secured for our future, but all of a sudden these risks have returned. So I think that this pattern is going to end badly for both sides.
Speaking of resources, you say global warming will make rich countries cleaner and richer and poor countries dirtier and poorer. I guess the second of those is not hard to understand, though it's tragic if you're there. Richer and cleaner, global warming will make rich countries?
Well, certainly in relative terms, perhaps in absolute terms as well, because we are the ones who are creating a lot of the technologies which need to be used by anybody, whether they're rich or poor, in order to make their industries cleaner. And so we will have some success in implementing those technologies. We can afford them much more easily, and we're the ones who are producing them, so it may create jobs for us, not exclusively, but in many cases. And the poor countries, on the other hand, you know, they have to pay the same price to put a scrubber on a smokestack. They have to pay the same price for the alternative fuels that are available in the marketplace. It's a much bigger burden for them. It's going to be harder for them to pay that burden. And so to the extent they do, they're going to be poor, but they probably won't be able to do it enough to avoid getting dirtier as well.
You say an enormous financial black market will arise outside of traditional, financial centers. What do you mean by that?
We're seeing this happen already. It's starting because the financial crisis that we had a couple of years ago is leading to more monitoring and more regulation of the financial markets. But there are some people who want to keep doing the kinds of exotic transactions that got us into trouble. And they're moving offshore. They're moving to these offshore tax havens and financial paradises. And some of those places already have as much activity as big markets like the United States. We're expecting the British Virgin Islands to have as many hedge funds as the U.S. if they don't already. Now, if you go on just even a betting website from one of these offshore havens, like let's say Cayman Islands or Bermuda, you're likely to already be able to trade or make bets on the value of the stock market or whether certain companies will go bankrupt. That is already a functioning derivatives market, and it's just going
to
grow.
Does that mean efforts to regulate won't work because it's just slipping out of their net entirely, you know, away from London and New York and Tokyo?
Not only will they slip out of the net, but they will still have effects on us back in the traditional markets. Because think about who's going to these new black markets. It's going to be the big-time investors who have a lot of money and they want to do these exotic and complex transactions. But they will still have money invested in the traditional markets. So if there's a crisis in the black market and there's no safety net there at all, there's nothing that's going to bail them out in these tiny little tax havens, then that crisis is going to reverberate back in the traditional markets because the investors will have to move their money around there too and start unloading their risks there too.
You say, and this may be a version of Patty's observation in Spokane, you say Americans will become the world's sales force. What do you mean?
It is a version of what Patty was saying, but it takes it even further because I think that in this country, one of the unique things that we have to offer to the world is the commercial culture that we started forging over 200 years ago in this nation of immigrants. You know, we had to find ways to sell things to people no matter where they were from, what their particular ethnicity or philosophy or religion was. We had to be able to find a way to sell to all of them. That's exactly the skill that we need in the global economy too because we're selling to people around the world. Now, not only does this help us to sell our own products better, but it also is something we can be paid to do to sell other people's products, and we can be paid to teach other people how to sell the American way.
But they don't know a commercial culture in, you know, Hong Kong or China or India, for heaven's sake. I mean, we're hardly alone in having a history of commercial culture, are we?
It's true, but we're much better than other people in finding that lowest common denominator. And I don't use that term pejoratively, but it's the thing that resonates with consumers everywhere. That's why we have Coca-Cola, but we're not drinking a Chinese or a French or a British or an Australian soft drink right now.
Go sell America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. David in Norfolk, Virginia. David, you're on the air with Daniel Altman.
Thanks, Tom. I have a small ad agency that represents a manufacturer here that makes furniture for the hotel and motel industry. Now, they've looked at manufacturing overseas where they could get a bigger profit, but they decided to keep it here in America, not necessarily for keeping American jobs here, but to protect their product because the stuff that's made overseas wasn't quite up to the standards they wanted to have here. My point, excuse me, was that if more American companies would kind of take that model, they could protect their product quality, as we've seen in Chinese drywall and other products, where they wouldn't have to do recalls. Sure, they'd make a little bit less of a profit, but they'd employ more jobs here, which keep more money here. And there's another side benefit to this that we kind of realized with this company is that when you're manufacturing here, you're not shipping your product all the way overseas here, which reduces the amount of fossil fuels, which helps out with the global warming question.
David, let us pick it up. What about the super quality path as an American path for economic health and jobs, Daniel?
I think the best thing is for Americans to have the choice. We can buy a cheaper product from overseas, which has the burden of using more fossil fuels in transportation, which may not be to the same quality. Or you can buy a product which is made in the United States, higher quality, less use of fossil fuels. And we can see this across a variety of different industries. The best thing is for the consumer to have the choice because there may be people with less money who can't afford to buy the higher quality product. But as long as that product is available in the market, we give people the opportunity to be informed and to get that product.
Can we build jobs on the super quality path in sufficient number? I mean, that's been Germany's claim to fame, you know. Best engineering in the world has been their reputation. There's great engineering in this country, too. Can we build a job pool big enough to drive that unemployment down on super quality?
I think we can because one of the things that this rapid growth of economies around the world means is that there are more people whose incomes are rising who will be able to afford high-quality American products in the future. So That's one reason why the growth in China and Brazil and India and other big economies could be good for us. But we need to establish beachheads in those markets so we can bring them our high-quality products. They're buying Mercedes now. We want them to buy American products, too.
One of the big conclusions that you draw here, big long-term trends you see, is pretty worrying. It makes me wonder if there's not something tragic underneath all this. You say the structure of political institutions will stop the world, from solving its biggest problems. If that's a long-term trend that we're all looking at, I mean, is all this just whistling in the wind anyway? Are we all going to be fried?
Well, one of the things I say in the book is a function of predictions and forecasts can be to alert us to problems that we need to fend off in the future so we can make changes now that will help us to live better in the future. And that's what I'm hoping will happen here. We have political institutions that, as I said before, make it very difficult for us to make upfront investments today, sacrifices we need to make today in order to reap the benefits in the long term. And we also have institutions which are very bad at forming coalitions. It's difficult for us to work with governments of other countries, especially when there's a free rider problem, when every country has the incentive to say, you guys do it, we'll sit back and reap the benefits of what you do in areas like fighting climate change, for example. We need to solve both of these problems. One thing we can do is, as voters, tell our politicians that we value these things. We want you to think about the long term. We want you to enter into coalitions with other countries to solve global problems. If we make their election contingent on that, they'll start to listen to us.
Daniel Altman, his new book is Outrageous Fortunes, Long-Term Investment. I'm not sure I can figure. Are you saying, is that a market answer? Is that an Obama-style answer? Are you lining up with that State of the Union speech where Obama was calling for that?
It's not bad to be non-aligned, right?
Well, but it's good to be clear as well. I mean, we've got a big political contest. You're saying stand up for the long-term health. Where do you see that?
I certainly endorse President Obama's statement that education, basic research and infrastructure should be priority investments for the future. They will raise the economy of the potential of our economy to grow, and investors will lend us the money to do it because it will help us to pay them back. Other things we can talk about later.
Daniel Altman's new book is Outrageous Fortunes. Daniel, it's been great talking with you this hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us at Facebook at On Point Radio. Hit the like button there. You'll get the early word on upcoming shows right here. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marika Spence, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.